thoughts. It is 7 o'clock. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. This is Wake Up Call.
Oh, Lord, sweet in the morning.
Sweet in the morning, indeed. Good morning, New York. Wednesday, August 24th. I'm Esther Amar, Ife Dancy on engineering duties. 67 degrees in the city at the moment. Your high today, 82 degrees. Coming up in our 7 o'clock hour.
All the birds got up at one time and flew off, and that's when the ground started shaking, and you can see the buildings over here, like, started shaking.
I've never been through an earthquake before, so just the whole building was shaking.
I'm sure I'm getting, like, 10 calls from my entire family being like, are you alive? Are you alive right now?
Witnesses in Washington, D.C. share what they saw, felt, and heard when an earthquake hit the East Coast yesterday at 1:51 p.m. The earthquake measured 5.9 on the Richter scale. The lunchtime tremble sent items crashing to the floor from store and office shelves. Buildings shook, lights flickered, terminals crashed. There were flight disruptions and delays, and thousands of panicked workers swarmed onto the streets as buildings were evacuated. Right here on Wall Street, we were evacuated. Now, there have been no reports of any major damage or injuries from the earthquake. The United States Geological Survey said the epicenter of the quake was in Mineral, Virginia, at a very shallow depth of 1 kilometer. But it was actually felt as far as Canada. Government institutions like the Pentagon and the U.S. Capitol were briefly evacuated as well. So what was your experience? Call us and let us know what happened, where you were, whether you were evacuated, what kind of damage was done. Share with us what happened to you. Dominic Strauss-Kahn, the former head of the International Monetary Fund, walked from a Manhattan court yesterday a free man. Charges of sexual assault by Nafissatou Diallo, a 32-year-old Guinean woman, were dismissed. But activists and advocates have asked, why was so much of her history and sexual attacks and encounters revealed? Academic, activist and author Salima Shatilat explains the law that was introduced that aimed to protect women and how lawyers and journalists managed to flout that. And it's Wednesday. That means issues of law and social justice tackled by legal correspondent Mimi Rosenberg in her segment In Brief, and In Peril and Privilege, Conversations on Masculinity. Founder of the Black Men's Exchange and an activist around identity, sexuality and sexual health, Cleo Monago joins us live in studio to talk about his work. All of that and more coming up, but we start with local, national and global news headlines. We say good morning to Wake Up Call's news editor, Christine Black. Morning, Christine.
Here are some of the day's headlines. Yesterday, criminal rape charges against Dominique Strauss-Kahn were dropped. The Manhattan DA, Cyrus Vance, went before a judge saying he no longer had confidence in the case and that he did not believe the accuser, Nafissatou Diallo. The next step is a civil suit Diallo is bringing against Strauss-Kahn, where the level of proof is lower. Esther will have more on this story later in the program. In Libya, dramatic pictures of opposition forces and civilians storming Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's compound were transmitted out of Tripoli yesterday. They were walking out with boxes of guns and other mementos from Gaddafi's living quarters. Fighters loyal to Gaddafi are sniping from rooftops, and there are sporadic bomb blasts, but for the most part, the capital is in opposition hands. Gaddafi's whereabouts are still unknown. In an audio-only address yesterday, he said he had left the capital after taking a tour and that he said the battle was not yet lost. Many were jubilant that the opposition had taken the first step towards controlling the country, but others are cautious until Gaddafi and his sons are found in custody. And there are still a number of Gaddafi loyalists fighting on his behalf. Moody's has downgraded Japan's sovereign credit rating, citing weak prospects for economic growth. That will make it difficult for the government to reduce its public debt burden, the largest in the world at 219% of GDP. Japan has been spending public money to boost the economy after an asset bubble collapse, and now the record high value of the yen is making exports less attractive to foreign buyers. The IMF says Japan needs to raise sales taxes and stop selling so many bonds to get its public debt under control. In U.S. news, states such as Vermont and Maine are concerned international free trade agreements could give companies a way to challenge state regulations and programs. For example, if the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership free trade agreement is put through, limits negotiated with the drug companies, the free trade agreement limits negotiations with drug companies for lower prices. What's to stop the companies from challenging the prices they've negotiated with companies to cover Medicaid patients? Another concern is water withdrawals, especially in Maine where bottled water is a big business. Will a free trade agreement supersede a state limit on how much water can be taken out of its aquifers? These challenges haven't come up yet, but free trade scholars say it's not out of the question. In New York City, the largest layoff since the Bloomberg administration came to power is about to happen at the Department of Education. 777 school employees are set to be let go by October. School aides will see the majority of layoffs. They're part of the District Council 37, the union which represents 95% of the employees to be laid off. 82 parent coordinators will also lose their jobs. A Bloomberg spokesperson says the workers are losing their jobs because the union would not agree to cost savings measures. The union said the Bloomberg administration had the money to pay them, they just chose not to. Now the union is emphasizing the important role of these workers being lost, saying layoffs will impact needy schools and neighborhoods most. And finally, in Parsippany, New Jersey, Greystone Psychiatric Hospital patients are boycotting therapy sessions over rule changes at their facility. The patients are upset about limits on access to the commissary, where they can get snacks and hang out with friends. The library and computer time is also being limited. The staff says patients should be spending that social time in more recovery-minded, evidence-based treatment, but the patients say that treatment amounts to coloring, playing board games, and listening to music. They would also like more group therapy sessions than the 1 hour a week. And those are some of the headlines for today. Please send your news and tips and reactions to wbaiheadlines@gmail.com. Again, that's wbaiheadlines@gmail.com. Or call and leave a message specifically for Wake Up Call News Headlines. Call 212-209-2815 to leave a comment. Again, that's 212-209-2815. Or tweet me at WBAI Headlines. Follow WBAI Headlines on Twitter for more information on today's stories. I'm Christine Black. Back to you, Esther.
Thanks, Christine. Here's Samori Benjamin with sports.
Good morning. This is Samori Benjamin, and here's a quick look at sports on this Wednesday morning. Last night in the Bronx, the Yankees returned home from a road trip where they hosted the Oakland A's. New York got behind 6-0, and that was the score when the Yanks began to make the rally in the eighth inning. They narrowed the deficit to 6-5 and had the bases loaded in the ninth inning with outfielder Nick Swisher at the plate. Swisher had homered earlier in the game, but in the ninth inning, he flew out to center field, and the Yankees would lose last night's ball game 6-5. The Yankees are neck and neck with the Boston Red Sox for first place of the American League East Division. Last night, Boston was in Texas, where they were victorious, so this morning, the two teams are deadlocked atop the standings for first place with records of 77 wins and 49 losses. The season probably cannot end fast enough for the New York Mets. They were in Philadelphia last night to face the first-place Philadelphia Phillies, and the Mets were beaten thoroughly for the second night in a row, falling by the final score of 9-4. And finally, longtime University of Tennessee women's head basketball coach Pat Summitt, who is one of the all-time legends of the coaching game, announced on Tuesday that she is battling early dementia of the brain. This is Samori Benjamin, WBAI.
Hi, this is Alec Baldwin, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York. Anything can happen. Support WBAI, Peace and Justice Radio in New York. Anything can happen.
Dear listeners, this is Indra Hardat. There's a great way to support your favorite community radio station, WBAI, and save on your taxes. You can donate your car, your truck, or your motorhome. We'll come pick up your vehicle for free and give you a receipt for your tax donation. It's easy. Just call our representative to find out if your vehicle qualifies at 866-WBAI-CAR. Again, that's 866-WBAI-CAR. Thank you for your continued support.
7:10, you're listening to Wake Up Call. Now, an earthquake hit the East Coast yesterday at 1:51 p.m. It measured 5.9 on the Richter scale, and the lunchtime tremble sent items crashing to the floor from store and office shelves. Buildings shook, lights flickered, terminals crashed. There were flight disruptions and delays, and thousands of panicked workers swarmed onto the streets as buildings were evacuated. Right here on Wall Street, we were evacuated, actually. Now, there have been no reports of any major damage or injuries from the earthquake. The U.S. Geological Survey said the epicenter of the quake was in Mineral, Virginia, at a very shallow depth of 1 kilometer, but it was actually felt as far as Canada. And the Pentagon and the U.S. Capitol were briefly evacuated. So here's Al Jazeera's report of what happened.
At 1:51 in the afternoon, everything started moving. A rare 5.9 magnitude earthquake jolted much of the East Coast, from Massachusetts to Ohio to Georgia. The U.S. Geological Survey said the quake occurred in central Virginia, about 165 kilometers south of Washington, D.C. It's the most severe quake in the area in more than a century.
It is an area that's had earthquakes in the past. This is a recognized seismic zone.
In Washington, the White House, the Pentagon, and the U.S. Capitol were all evacuated. As the building shook, workers in the nation's capital streamed out of their offices.
All the birds got up at one time and flew off, and that's when the ground started shaking. And you can see the buildings over here, like, started shaking.
I've never been through an earthquake before, so just the whole building was shaking.
I'm sure I'm going to get, like, 10 calls from my entire family being like, are you alive? Are you alive right now?
At the recently renovated Washington National Cathedral, three of the four spires broke off in the quake. It's now closed for inspection. The quake occurred some 11 kilometers below the Earth's surface, and officials warned residents that aftershocks are possible. Officials are also assessing the greater property damage and expect most of the damage to have hit older buildings. Flights and trains across the U.S. were delayed. A nuclear reactor was shut down and phone service disrupted. Many offices closed early so workers could check on damage to their homes. The best news, officials say no one was seriously hurt. Rosalind Jordan, Al Jazeera, Washington.
And so where were you when the quake hit? Share with us your stories on 212-209-2900. Now, we were evacuated right here on Wall Street. Actually, remember, I was talking with Hugh Hamilton, who hosts Talk Back at 3 o'clock on WBAI. And I was sitting in my chair, and where I sit faces the river, faces the water. And I literally felt as though somebody had picked my chair up from underneath me, with me still sitting in it, picked it up, and then the chair just started to shake. And I was shaking too, and I thought, I just froze. It was such a weird moment. Do you know what it felt like? I felt like I was in a weird Hollywood horror movie. And I thought, oh my God, what's happening? And then I could just feel this rumble, like something was moving under the entire floor. And I'm just sitting there, my hands are gripping the seats, thinking, oh, ish, I need to call my mother in Ghana. It was just, I was so freaked out. And so anyway, then folks started, you could hear people moving around, and the whole building was evacuated. So I went down onto Wall Street, and you saw people streaming out of their buildings, and people were trying to call home and call people and check their loved ones. This, by now, we knew that it had started in Washington, D.C., and there was reports back and forth. You then couldn't get cell coverage. You actually couldn't get any coverage. So people were trying to call, and they couldn't necessarily get coverage. I decided to take a walk to my local smoothie truck, which is just down the road a couple of blocks. And there was a whole bunch of folk gathered there. And there was some, I started talking to all the people and asking them what did they feel. And the folks who were on Wall Street, who were really up high, said that all their lights flickered. The terminals went. This guy said he got really dizzy and started getting a headache. And of course, we're not that far away from 9/11. So there was an absolute moment of panic. And they came out of their buildings first. They were like, wow, we were amazed it took you all so long to get out of the building. So then I said, well, you know what? It's 2012. It's a campaign year. Let the Obama conspiracies begin. Small joke. But where were you when it happened? 212-209-2900. I know I was really shaken, and it was very good to just sit down on solid ground. And that was a 5.9 on the Richter scale earthquake. Where were you? Share your stories. What happened? Did you feel anything where you were? I heard there was a lot of motion out in certain parts of Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn, but other parts I didn't feel anything at all. 212-209-2900. This is Wake Up Call. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'm calling about the earthquake. Yes. I didn't feel anything, but my husband and my babysitter, they said that the whole chandelier was swinging.
Oh, wow.
Just that, and then my daughter was working at the for the Intel project. She said the closet next to her was like a dancing or something. You know, this is her expression. She's 16 years old.
Wow. Where was this?
And this was in Manhattan.
And this was in Manhattan. Whereabouts in Manhattan?
She works at the Columbia Presbyterian for the research. She's doing Intel project.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Six floor. But my point is this. My point is, I think that it's coming because the nature is angry, and the nature has done her job towards the eastern coast. Now they're coming to the west because we might get a big one. Who knows?
Who knows? Thank you so much. Let us know where you were. As I said, that's where I was. We were in the building. We were evacuated. Certainly, I know I was shaking, but where were you? Kathy Davis's idea was that we all needed to go to the Bronx because the Bronx is on mainland. And I said, you know what? Maybe we'll be safer by the water. To which Kathy said, have you ever heard of a tsunami? Crazy idea. 212-209-2900. Share where you were for that earthquake yesterday. You're on the line. This is Wake Up Call. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hello, I'm on the air.
You are indeed. Go ahead. Where were you when it?
Hi.
Where were you at 1:51 yesterday? What happened?
Hi. I was in Queens. I was at the doctor's office, and I actually felt it was like an inner rumbling that was going on. And I paused for a moment. I felt my chair shaking. I felt the building swaying. And it was only like a two to three story building. And I turned to the person next to me, and we both said at the same time, do you feel that? And at that moment, we turned around and all the doctors and the patients started coming out of the room. And it was really surreal because I turned around, like one side of the building was all glass windows and you could see outside, but everyone was continuing, you know, with their life and like nothing happened. And I'm like, so at that point I was like, okay, so is the building about to explode? Is there a gas leak or something like that? And at that point, somebody's husband had called and said that there was an earthquake in Virginia. And so I called,
where were you exactly? Whereabouts in?
Queens Village.
Oh, you're in Queens Village.
New York, right.
Right.
It felt like something out of the movie, like Inception, like where everyone was just continuing with everything and the building was shaking. It's like, what? It was just a weird, weird, weird feeling.
Did you feel like you were in a weird Hollywood movie set for a second?
I did. It felt like Inception.
That's what I felt.
It felt like the movie Inception.
Yeah, and, without the money, right? Thank you for that call. Thank you.
Can I say one thing?
Yes, go ahead. Go ahead.
I called my daughter. My daughter and her best friend are at my house, and they said at that point, you know, they were listening and dancing to music, and the dog just like made a dash for the hallway, and he stood in the doorway, and he's looking at them like, "Are you crazy?" And then at that point, they noticed the dog staring at them, and then the earthquake came. So the dog knew before everyone else knew.
That's very interesting because when I heard the sound, animals react the fastest. It's like they feel something deeper. Oh, yeah. Evidence, of course, that everybody says animals are more intelligent than human beings. And all the birds flew off moments before people started to feel the buildings shake. Human beings were always the slowest. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for that call. 212-209-2900. Glad to hear that everybody's okay. No serious injuries reported, but share with us where you are. We'll take a couple more calls. You're on the air. This is Wake Up Call. Good morning.
Good morning to you. I was just listening to you practically all morning. But I was at home in East Elmhurst with my grandson.
Right.
And he was standing behind me in the chair. And I said to him, stop shaking the chair. He said, but Grammy, I'm not doing that. And then I happened to look at my plant, and the leaves were like a deep breeze had come by. Wow. They were fluttering, and this I'd never seen before. Plus, outside got dark. The sun was out 1 minute, and then it was dark. Then I checked with one or two of my neighbors, and one neighbor said his house was shaking.
Oh, wow.
So I said, well, it is an earthquake, and I've been in this area for almost 60 years, and I remember a long time ago we had another one. But I'm right aboard from LaGuardia Airport, so...
Oh, wow.
But you feel tremors sometimes late at night.
Yeah. Everybody okay in the house, though?
Oh, everyone was fine.
Good.
Thank God.
Good, good. Thank the Lord. Thank you. Thank you so much for that call.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing your stories and experiences. Hope everybody is okay. That's the most important thing. But it did feel like I was on the set of a movie without the clothes or the check, but it did feel like I was on set. When the caller said it was like Inception, I said, that's what it was like. It was like Inception. 7:20, you're listening to Wake Up Call. Now, Dominique Strauss-Kahn walked from a Manhattan court yesterday a free man. All charges of sexual assault made in May by Nafissatou Diallo, a 33-year-old Guinean woman, were dismissed. The former head of the International Monetary Fund was greeted by protesters as he walked out of court. They carried banners, called for justice and chanted, "Put him on trial." He made a brief statement outside his home saying that he was looking forward to going home. Now, attorneys for the alleged victim of the former leader of the IMF had requested a special prosecutor because they felt Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance was biased. But a New York appeals court denied that request. Now, one question that advocates and activists and so many was asking was this. Why was so much of the alleged victim's sexual history and apparent sexual encounters made public? And wasn't there some kind of protection for victims alleging sexual assault from having their history revealed? Wasn't there legislation to protect them? And so how was it we all got to know so much in the first place? Now, to talk about specifically that element of this story, we're joined by Salah Mishatillet, an academic and author who teaches English and Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania and is a co-founder of A Long Walk Home. It's an organization that uses art therapy, visual and performing arts to end violence against women and girls. Salamisha, good morning. Welcome to Wake Up Call.
Good morning. Thank you.
So I know that it's the name that I've heard it called is the Rachel Law. So explain to us what this is and how it was supposed to protect women where sexual assault allegations are made.
Yeah, so the Rape Shield laws came about in 1974 in Michigan. It was the first state to institute them, and then late 70s, early 80s, every state has, you know, picked it up subsequently, and each state kind of has their own version, but they're you know, federally mandated consistencies, let's say. So the Rape Shield law essentially came about because women who had come forward and made accusations of sexual assault, their sexual history would be part of the defendant's strategy to undermine her credibility. And rape shield laws are put in place because there's a to protect women who, you know, who come forward, but also if a woman was sexually active, that did not mean that she was therefore more likely to lie on the stand. So the thought before was that if a woman was sexually inactive, she was more likely to be telling the truth, and if a woman was sexually active, she was more likely to have had consensual relationships with the defendant and therefore be lying about rape. So the rape shield laws were put into place to take away that idea that if a woman is sexually active, that therefore she's lying about rape. And there's three kind of caveats or three exceptions to the rape shield laws that I think, you know, everyone should know. One is if there's evidence of semen that comes from someone besides the defendant, then that's you know, admissible. And then the other two are kind of trickier. The second one is if there's evidence that the accuser had a prior sexual relationship with the defendant, then all of that is admissible. And the third one is if there's evidence somehow that suggests that the defendant's constitutional rights will be violated, then her sexual history is admissible. And that one's even more grayer than the second one. So that's the rape shield law as it stands. 11 states kind of have something what we call a catch-all, where it's up to the judge's discretion to include evidence of her sexual history.
So then how do we end up with a situation where it feels like we had all this intimate detail around the gang rape and the sexual assault that Nafissatou Diallo spoke about, and it was all over the media in pretty extraordinary detail when you have those rape shield laws in effect? How could that happen?
Yeah, so the rape shield laws actually only are in place when the trial is occurring, right? And so the prosecution cannot include that, and the defendant cannot sort of, defense attorney cannot claim to be using that in order to affect whether something is going to go to trial or not. However, our 24/7 news media cycle and the various media outlets we have, I think defense attorneys are obviously savvy and strategic. And so if you can leak the information beforehand, you can bias jurors. So the rape shield laws were put into place to make sure that jurors were not biased. And now you have a culture and a climate in which information can be leaked before it even goes to
trial and potential jurors, but also a kind of the larger culture gets impacted. And here you can see that the great amount of political and public pressure that the Manhattan prosecutor's office felt led them to making a decision whether they didn't really want to go to trial because they felt like there was reasonable doubt. So, you know, the most, I think the beginning of using the 24/7 media cycle and particularly like YouTube and these other outlets to discredit the accuser we saw with the Kobe Bryant case, when there's all this, you know, quote-unquote evidence that she wanted to be famous and that she was her American Idol video was leaked or things like that. So that's where it began. And now I think with the Dominic Strauss-Kahn case, we saw it amplified and you know, ratcheted up to such a degree that the New York Post can run a cover, very unethical cover, about her being a hooker.
And so then for sexual abuse, sexual assault, rape advocates, activists, does there need to be a new strategy about fighting for something that enables that particular culture to be somehow controlled so that in the high-profile cases that we've seen, you don't end up with a situation that we had in this particular case, where it feels like if that is the conversation, how are you ever even going to get to court? Because everything is decided before there is even the conversation about a trial. And without these apparent airtight cases, and even then there's a question mark, how is there then a fight back against that culture so that at least the possibility of justice and a day in court becomes a greater possibility?
Yeah, well, I actually think one way to do it is even strengthening the rape shield laws even more. And by that I mean, I don't think in it, only within the sort of strict, narrow case of the event that took place, I don't think that the accuser's sexual history with the defendant, for example, should come up in the trial, right? So it should only be within the narrow confines of the situation that they're talking to. So I still think even the current rape shield laws should be stricter because they don't fully protect the victim or the accuser's rights. So with that said, I think that, you know, our larger culture is what, you know, feminist activists call a rape culture, which ultimately means that most of us are conditioned to think that when a woman or man comes forward and says that they've been sexually assaulted, we automatically blame them, right? It's the only crime in which, like, the victim blaming is so intense and so immediate. And I think, in terms of advocates and activists, I think we have to do, in conversation with law enforcement, media personalities, and, you know, educators, we have to do a more effective job in trying to lessen victim blaming and see sexual violence and other forms of violence against women, domestic violence, as crimes committed against victims, as opposed to a victim coming forward and lying about something that happened to her. Now, I think activists and advocates have been doing this for a long time. That's why you have rape shield laws in the first place. But it's almost like these issues need to be not only rebranded, but that there has to be more consistent feminist consciousness around how we see victims of sexual violence in our culture. And it just takes systemic effort, but it also takes effort by individuals who tend to be victim blaming to sort of rethink their position as well.
And is it not the case that this is a community engagement? I mean, I often have these discussions. Once we've had them on air, I take them to social media and Facebook. And a comment that was made again and again on my page was that from some men was that they were surprised that there wasn't more outrage from more women. And my point was that when it comes to sexual assault, this is a community engagement and it's a community fight. It's not a gender fight. And when you make it that narrow, it problematizes it for everybody. And so part of the conversation is a broader engagement and an understanding that all of us are involved and engaged in that fight. And it's not about simply condemning those who are innocent. It's about, as you said, this is one of the few crimes where it is just part and parcel, not to just to blame the victim, but for that person to have to absolutely defend, explain. And the possibility of them being besmirched happens again and again and again. When the rape shield laws were put into place, just as we close, it was before the advent of this crazy 24-hour culture. What element, if it was strengthened, could change that. Last thought.
No, I wonder if part of this story is about the way the media covered the case, and particularly kind of high-profile media outlets like the New York Times and the New York Post, and the sort of lack of sensitivity that you consistently saw in their stories. And I think that there has to be more accountability for the journalists themselves and the kind of coverage that they're giving, because that completely shapes public opinion, which therefore then affects, you know, the prosecutor's office in really sad and tragic ways. And what's really compelling about this case is that the accuser, by all things, wanted the case to go forward. So we have a sense that justice could not be achieved because of the ways in which she was already vilified by so many different constituencies, but particularly mainstream media.
Silent Mr. Tillett, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Bye.
Thank you so much. 7:31, that means it's time for In Brief with legal correspondent Mimi Rosenberg. Good morning, Mimi.
Well, good morning, Esther, and I've already ordered our T-shirts. To say that we've survived the New York City earthquake, but the question is, will Indian Point? But we can go there another time. Well, TANF at 15, a shredded safety net. This week marks the 15th anniversary of the enactment of the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, TANF. In August 1966, President Clinton signed the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Act, replacing aid for families with dependent children with TANF as the national welfare program for needy Americans. 15 years later, the truth is that TANF has shredded the safety net. It has been a disaster for poor families, the majority of whom are headed by single mothers. Benefit receipt has fallen from 3/5 of poor children pre-reform to just 1/5 of poor children post-reform, and benefit amounts have plummeted to less than $5 a person a day in most states. Tim Casey, senior staff attorney with Legal Momentum and longtime welfare advocate, talks with us about the vanishing safety net for women and children. Good morning, Tim.
Yeah, good morning, Mimi. I'm glad everyone survived the earthquake yesterday.
Indeed. Yeah. I was wondering more about my own senses, actually, than the earthquake. It just shows you what our place of location is emotionally. Tim, give us a brief synopsis of the devolution of welfare benefits from Aid for Families with Dependent Children, AFDC, in 1996 to the now TANF program.
Yeah, well, I think the most fundamental change made by the so-called welfare reform law in 1996 was to change federal policy to give the states actually a financial incentive to reduce welfare assistance to poor families, because under the new welfare reform federal statute, the states were told the money that we are giving you that you can use to aid poor families, you can use for other purposes as well. So that if you reduce aid to poor families, you can use the federal dollars, which were in theory intended for aid for the poor, for other purposes. So across the country, we saw virtually every state engage in actions that basically reduced aid to needy and eligible families. I think you cited some of the statistics. Just prior to the time the law was enacted, studies showed that 80% of eligible children were receiving benefits. The most recent study, which is outdated, it was 2005, showed that by that time already the percentage of eligible children receiving benefits had gone from 80% to 40%. And in virtually every state, as a result of these diverse federal financial incentives, the amount of aid received by needy families fell far, far below the poverty level. So welfare reform just really has been a disaster for poor families. It's made them more poor if they do get aid, and even more extremely poor if they can't get over the bureaucratic barriers that so many states have erected to make it difficult for needy families to get aid.
Well, let's go back and parse out and delve into some of the things that you just summarized for us. For example, what are some of the loss or diminution of benefits that people receive under TANF?
Well, even prior to welfare reform and TANF, states had near total discretion in setting the level of benefits, and in many states, benefits were already below the official poverty level in most states. But there were some parts of the pre-existing federal scheme that did encourage states to periodically at least raise their benefit levels to keep pace with changes in the cost of living. All that was repealed by the welfare reform law. So the welfare reform law repealed the federal protections that were in the prior program that encouraged states to provide more adequate benefits and that encouraged states to provide aid to all those families who are eligible and needy. So with the removal of those federal protections and with the creation of perverse financial incentives allowing states to use welfare assistance for other purposes, we saw welfare reform basically turn into caseload purges throughout the country. And, you know, what makes...
No.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead, please.
Well, you know, often, of course, as I'm sure you know, but, you know, people on... You know, parents who are receiving welfare are attacked for being lazy, being unwilling to work. But the reality today, I mean, even both before and after reform, was a significant percentage of parents who are receiving welfare, and of course most welfare recipients are children, but a significant percentage of the parents receiving welfare assistance are employed, are working. Now, some of them are working part-time because they can't get more hours or because they can't get the child care they need to work more hours. And some of them are working full-time but at very low wages, so they're still eligible for some assistance. So the problem has been not that people are not willing to work, but that, and obviously I think in recent years, the recession has underscored the reality of this point. The jobs are not there, or the child care is not there, that low-income parents need to work. For many low-income parents, the biggest employment barrier is that they can't afford child care. And in our country, we do a very poor job of making child care available to low-income parents who cannot work unless child care is made available. Most of the adults receiving welfare assistance have a child who's below school age, so they desperately need child care in order to work, and that often isn't available.
Well, now, the federal policy incorporated mandatory work assignments in TANF. How did that impact specifically on the opportunity to receive an education? And didn't it actually really institutionalize low-wage jobs? One might even call it an indenture.
Well, yes. Prior to the welfare reform laws, there were work requirements for most parents receiving welfare. But those requirements were structured so that, you know, if a parent who had not been able to complete their high school education wanted to do so in order to give themselves a real opportunity to get a living wage job, they could do so. So the federal work requirement rules encouraged families to improve their education and training so they could qualify for jobs that pay a living wage. Welfare reform basically transformed the rules governing work requirements to say not only, you know, must you work or engage in education and training, but you must take any first job that is made available to you. We won't allow you to participate in education training for better jobs, whether or not the job that's available pays a living wage, whether or not there's medical benefits, whether or not there's sick days, whether or not there's vacation days. So it stressed employment at any wage in any job without regard to whether or not the employment would be secure and stable and allow you to have a real chance to escape poverty.
Now, aren't there also significant roadblocks that prevent or disqualify more and more of what are predominantly women from enrolling in TANF or staying on TANF in any event?
Yeah, well, of course, you know, the majority of poor families in this country are families headed by single mothers. And so, you know, not surprisingly, the majority of families who need welfare assistance are single mothers, in part because of scarcity of jobs and lack of child care. And what happens in so many states now is that the application process has been made so cumbersome and so difficult that many families simply can't get in the door even though they're eligible. And we do a lot of work at Legal Momentum where we're working on domestic violence issues. And one complaint we've heard many times since welfare reform was enacted is that sometimes the inability, a woman's inability to access welfare benefits means a woman who's suffering domestic violence means that she cannot leave an abusive spouse. So, you know, the inability to get in the door, or the inadequacy of the benefits if you do get in the door, leaves so many women in desperate situations, either where they must stay with an abusive spouse, or basically make themselves homeless, allow themselves to become homeless, and enter into the homelessness system, which, as you know, is a really dreadful system.
Now, there is also the sanction process, which we can't ignore, since that's a major part of some of the work that I do at the Legal Aid Society.
Right. Well, you know, both before and after welfare reform, there were work requirements on the federal law for most parents receiving welfare assistance. But under the pre-welfare reform scheme, there were protections in the federal statute, in the federal regulations, that reduced the probability that a state would say you were not complying when, in fact, you were. So there were a series of procedural protections regarding adequacy of notice and opportunity to be heard. Because often what we find in experiences, I'm sure you know, is that someone will get a notice in the mail saying we are sanctioning you for not showing up for a work requirement meeting interview when the person never received the notice in the first place that was supposed to, you know, to come in for the interview. So often the welfare system, because it's a bureaucracy that is not designed to be responsive to human needs, it makes mistakes. It makes mistakes about what people have or have not done, and generates notices of sanction which are completely invalid, but without the right procedural protections, they would nevertheless result in sanctions, and that often happens throughout the country.
Now, Tim, Congress must enact legislation by September 30th to reauthorize or otherwise extend TANF. Now, despite what the complaints are, which are massive, what can we expect from Congress, and what is essential if TANF is to become an effective safety net?
Well, clearly what we need is more, to be honest, a lot more money, which seems, you know, very, very difficult in the current political climate. We need more money, and we need new federal rules, new federal standards that say to the states, your benefits must be adequate, and you must aid as many as possible of those who are eligible. We need a new federal policy thrust that creates jobs and creates child care for unemployed, needy parents. So that's what we need. The reality is we can probably expect things not to get any better than they are, unfortunately, and maybe to get worse. When President Obama came into office in the Recovery Act, they actually put $5 billion extra federal dollars over 2 years into the TANF program, which many states used to create jobs for low-income parents. So they put their money where their mouth was, at least to some degree. But when that money was about to expire this time last year, and the states and anti-poverty advocates were urging Congress to provide more funding to keep more low-income parents employed, and provide emergency assistance to keep people from becoming homeless. Basically, Republican opposition in the Senate blocked the extension. And, of course, this is at a time when, in theory, the Democrats control both the House and the Senate. Now the political climate is for TANF is just far worse. Despite the dreadful problems and need for more money and for better federal policies to make the programs more consumer-friendly, the reality is that the House, you know, is unlikely to do anything as it hopefully, you know, votes to extend TANF to make the program better. And there's some significant possibility that the House, as the price of agreeing to keeping TANF functioning as a federal program, will try to insist upon changes that make the program even more inaccessible and benefits even less adequate.
Well, at this time, TANF is indeed turned 15, and we must make the administration and Congress restore an adequate safety net. We once had a national welfare rights movement that pushed the agenda, and now there's an End Poverty Now coalition that's going to do the same thing. Benefits must be raised. Steps must be taken to ensure that aid is provided promptly to all those who are eligible. And the major element of that is, Tim?
More federal dollars. It's basically a federal agenda to put more money into the program and to set national eligibility standards, minimum eligibility standards that all states must observe, the same way that's been done in the food stamp program. And we've seen that the food stamp program has been much more responsive to the recession than the TANF program. As unemployment and poverty has increased over the last 2 years, the food stamp program has kept pace. The TANF program has not. And the reason the food stamp program has kept pace is because it has national minimum federal eligibility standards, and we need the same in TANF.
Tim Casey, attorney with Legal Momentum and long-term welfare advocate, thanks very much for joining us. I'm Mimi Rosenberg for In Brief.
Thank you, Mimi. 7:45, time now for Peril and Privilege, conversations on masculinity. And we're joined live in studio this morning by Cleo Monago. Cleo is described as an innovative voice among African-American same-gender-loving men. He founded the national body of the Black Men's Exchange, BMX, back in 1989, and it's a national organization that provides educational, empowerment, and wellness opportunities with a particular emphasis on same-gender-loving and bisexual black males. Its mission, to engage issues that impact the lives of diverse black men toward building self-esteem, respect, good health, and community. Now, BMX has served and impacted the lives of over 300,000 black men in the Bay Area, Los Angeles, New York City, Baltimore, and Miami. Now, Cleo also founded and is CEO of the African American Advocacy Support Services and Survival Institute, known as AMASI. It's a national non-profit organization, and from it, he created the AMASI National Centers for Wellness and Health in order to provide HIV/AIDS treatment and prevention services using a mental health model that was culturally specific to African-American identity. The first opened in Oakland, and now there are centers in South Central Los Angeles, Atlanta, Georgia, and right here in Harlem, New York. Cleo Monago, live in studio. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Thank you for joining us. If we take a step back and ask you about your personal journey in terms of that term, same gender loving, talk about how that personal journey impacted your choice to set up the Survival Institute and the Black Men's Exchange.
Well, luckily, sometimes I say luckily, sometimes I say unfortunately, I was a very sensitive kid and a very analytical kid. And I always watched what was occurring around me with great focus and try to figure things out. And to be try to be clear, there was a lot of challenging and troubling things as a black person that were occurring around me in terms of how we referenced ourselves, some things we said about ourselves or put ourselves down, which started off with you black, blah, 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 blah. Maybe you've heard those kind of things before. And I was very confused by those things in terms of I saw them as being destructive. And many things I can get into, which maybe will come out of this conversation, that I just noticed as a young person that this was not this is not helpful, and I didn't want to participate. At the same time, I don't want to participate in terms of perpetuating, I should say. I want to participate in terms of countering it or bringing attention to it toward managing and resolving those things. I also realized at a very young age that I was a same-gender-loving person and that we live in a society, regardless of our sexuality, that was not affirming of us. And there were concepts, both political, like gay, and even Democratic, Republican, all kinds of things that were occurring in society that were offered to us as our only options that were not really affirming and that did not provoke, trigger us to be the best we could be as healthy black people.
And so when we think about masculinity, and it's often heteronormative, it's often defined as heterosexual, and there's a very narrow specific focus around that. And now I talk often about emotional justice, mm-hmm. and that is the need to deal with the legacy of untreated trauma mm-hmm. as a result of just what it has meant to be African American and survive these 500 years, Absolutely. Generation after generation after generation. And part of the inheritance of that, the battle to survive through slavery and Jim Crow and civil rights, has been, yes, that warrior survival spirit, yes. but also the untreated trauma that has literally gone from womb to child, womb to child, womb to child.
That's exactly what I recognized as a kid
yeah.
that I could not get with and normalize and be complacent about.
And so for you, knowing that you were same-gender loving very young, how did you navigate your community accepting you as that person, or was that a very comfortable, easy journey for you?
Well, at the risk of sounding strange, I didn't have a lot of investment in community acceptance. I thought the community was kind of crazy. Again, going back to the issues that you raised in terms of why the trauma issues, the destructive behaviors, the unattended to traumas that became culture and normalized, I couldn't get with it. So I did not use society or even my community as having enough credibility to question who I was at a very young age. So the lack of needing that approval, because I had an analysis of it that that was not more important than me in terms of my self-concept, I was never really distracted in terms of getting to know myself and embrace myself, because I did not use that as a source of frame of reference for me in terms of whether I was a good person or not. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So my journey was very independent as a young person, because as a matter of fact, I thought I was the only one on earth because I didn't know any other St. John Loving
people. Oh, really?
Yeah. And it was kind of a place of...
How young were you when you knew for yourself?
Eight.
Oh, eight. Very young.
Yeah. And it was kind of a place to be outside of this society. I thought it was special. And I didn't have any problems with it because, like I said, again, going back to the comparison issue, the contrast, like this is better than that. So I can handle this.
So then in the creation of Amasi, what was it that said, okay, we need these mental health and culturally specific models to deal with these issues, to look at things like holistic health, mm-hmm. In order to move forward, in order to do that healing work? Talk a bit about that.
Well, one of the things that I noticed in the midst of examining and acknowledging the post-traumatic behavior in our community was there was no solution. There was nothing in the landscape to address it. I was a musician for a while, and I also worked simultaneously in community mental health. And I noticed that traditional community mental health systems were not built around the specifics of Black life and culture, or with specific attention to the trauma experience toward resolving that. Things were based on Freud and Jung and European experiences that made no mention or consideration of this particular experience. So when I attempted to bring in a Black considerable lens into traditional mental health services, it didn't work. There was problems. I was getting fired and all kinds of things was going on because those systems were resistant to making being Black important enough to be a focus. So in the process of trying to work in traditional systems and those things not working for myself personally as a professional or for my community, I decided to build something myself. And again, the Amasi Center is for everybody. It's for the whole community because the issues that we've talked about are relevant to the whole community in terms of a culture's or a people's trauma. So the organization was built to engage through different techniques and strategies and methodologies resolving the issues relevant to that trauma as Black people.
And so one of the things I always believe is that when you do that kind of transformative work, mm-hmm. the visionary work, that there are discoveries that you make about yourself through what you encounter with other people. And I'm wondering about the kinds of discoveries that you made in working with Black folks in developing those models that either moved you or changed you or surprised you or impacted you.
Well, one of the things that surprised me in my young naivete when I first started in my early 20s was that I assumed that the worst I would experience would be disagreement, maybe, with people disagreeing. But I didn't realize I would experience, in some cases, such severe resistance. That I didn't fathom that as I start developing my work. And there's people in our community who are very well assimilated and have learned to value, rather kills them, if you will, assimilating into the larger system, even if it's Blackless. LESS in this instance. And so I call it white accommodationist behavior. And my work is Black affirming, which is not white accommodationist. It's not white attacking either. I want to make that very clear. But in this culture, we've been trained that to be Black affirming or pro-Black is an anti-white reaction. And no, it's not. It's a pro-Black, Black affirming, Black restorative reaction. But it's people in our community who don't realize that, who are engulfed in white approval, like, for example, this might sound like an extreme example, when you talk about the image of God or the image of Jesus, when you say that person might not necessarily be white, but might be everything, or maybe a person that's Black, if you look at Jesus and where they were from, there's resistance in our community because some of us have been very well acculturated into white accommodationist thinking. So I've dealt with some severe resistance to my work from that energy. And I didn't expect that. I didn't expect it to be such severe resistance in some cases.
And so so if it started off in 1989, you've had some years under your belt now. As you've moved forward, how have you chosen to navigate that kind of resistance. And once again, those folks, because all of us, when it comes to this emotional justice issue and dealing with that legacy of untreated trauma, it manifests itself in all kinds of ways. It could sometimes just be purely homophobic. And sometimes people's stances are contradictory. They may believe in the importance of the work, but take issue with the person who's doing the work. They may want to benefit from the effort that the person has made, but take issue with the person who created the project in the first place. So there's sometimes a contradictory way in which we engage even our own healing.
Well, that helps me to answer your question better. I understand, as a student of Black trauma since I was a kid, an active acknowledger of this phenomena, not to be personally reactionary or abusive or combative to the extent that I can be. Sometimes just being a Black male in a room is considered combative without even opening your mouth. But trying to not be involved in that myself and turn people off or shut people down. I understand so-called homophobia in the Black community. I understand, from my perspective, Black male disorientation, Black male terror and fear, Black male resistance to being compromised, being trained to think that a homosexual was an actually compromised male and not wanting no association in the desperate attempts to resurrect and restore and make Black manhood powerful and using American patriarchy as a frame of reference. I understand all of that. I think I've been successful because, as opposed to being reactionary, defensive, and cold, traumatizing in response to people resisting me, I say, I understand. I get it. I don't have the same perspective of you in terms of being anti-homosexual, being a homosexual, but I can engage what you're talking about, and I'm also willing to create room to hear you and hear what you're saying. But one thing I strongly request is respect. And if you don't have the capacity to be respectful, I think you have some issues personally to take a look at, because being respectful is a sign of courage. And being disrespectful is often a sign of just the opposite. You can't handle the engagement, so you shut down. And so often when I put those kind of concepts on the table for consideration, people are willing to have a conversation, including people who have been historically very anti. Because most people's anti-other people perspective are based on myth, often unaddressed myth. I mean, you often refer to the history of unaddressed trauma. Well, there's also a history of unaddressed myth, mm-hmm. and things that have become normalized and mistaken as fact, because nobody has created space to address it. Well, I create a lot of space to address things, including same gender loving Africans that tend not to have been addressed that much. And I understand it, so I don't react like, oh my God, or F you, or some type of, you know, cold traumatizing reaction. It's very important to be strategically focused and calm in how you deal with people who have been traumatized.
And so then, as we close, you are a builder and a creator and a visionary, no question about that, in terms of the work that you do. What's your next, when you think about the next place where you need to kind of target your lens and think about where the work needs to be, what does that look like for you?
Well, the next part of my work, which I'm excited about, there's two. One is writing books, and the other is getting involved in film. Film is one of the most powerful mediums in this society, and I want to explore that more in terms of bringing these issues to the film landscape for community-wide engagement.
So then, if folks would like to learn more about all of your projects from Amasi, the Black Men's Exchange, let them know some places where they can contact you, the website, all that good stuff.
Okay, well, Amasi, the whole name is Amasi Centers for Wellness, Education, and Culture. You can get us at www.amasi.com. Amasi is A-M-A-S-S-I. The Black Men's Exchange is bmxnational.com. You can reach us by email at bmxnational@gmail.com.
Okay, so I'm going to put all those details up on my Facebook and on our website as well for folks who have more interest and would like to know more. It felt like a long time, but it went very quickly.
Yes, it did.
Cleo Monago, live in studio. Peril and Privilege, Conversations on Masculinity. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. That brings us to the end of this morning's Wake Up Call. Thank you to the entire Wake Up Call team. That is Sharon Louise Harper, our executive producer, Christine Black, our news headlines editor, Samori Benjamin, our sports headlines editor, Ife Dancy, our engineer, Din Clark, and Rita Rahman, our producers. To the Radio Roots team, coming up at 8, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. You can check me out on Facebook under my name, Esther Armour, where I continue many of the conversations that we start right here on the airwaves. You've been listening to Wake Up Call. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. I'm Esther Armour. Good morning, New York.
There are voices of people who need this place.